This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I'm going to focus this talk on why late failure is based on proximal endograft failure. So why does this occur? Physician factors, so you could have inaccurate implementation, a purely technical reason for failure, or poor patient selection and planning. As Dr. Quinones-Baldrich mentioned, you could have a short angulated or conical neck, orthrombus or calcium at the neck, where that patient probably wasn't a good candidate for an endovascular repair in the first place. There could be undersizing of the stent graft that could eventually lead to failure. We know that the diseased aortic neck will progress over time. And there could be device failure with postoperative stent graft migration. So the options for treatment to salvage the failing endograft include endovascular, hybrid, and open surgical repair options. I'm actually going to focus a little more on the less standard endovascular treatment options for this talk. So what strategy should you employ? It really depends on the patient's underlying anatomy and physiology, and also the available interventional options that you have at your institution and what you feel comfortable with. So this talk is actually going to assume that either the patient with the late failure, the late type 1 endoleak, has either otherwise already undergone proximal balloon dilation, placement of a proximal cuff, and or a large Palmas stent, or is not a candidate for these standard options. So how should we think about treating these late type 1 endoleaks? I've divided it into three categories because I think that the way to think about treating it is different based on what the problem is. So you could augment the neck and use something like endo anchors. You can perform a direct attack on the neck with transcatheter embolization using coils, glue, or onyx, or any combination of those things. Or you can think about raising the neck with chimney grafts and the Nellix device, as Dr. Quinones-Baldrich mentioned, or using fenestrated or branch devices. So the failing endograft, what about augmenting the neck? Well, the endo anchor system, which probably a lot of you have used, was initially designed to improve the fixation and sealing in primary endograft cases within the proximal neck. It may be helpful in those cases where you have a very short or highly angulated neck. It's contraindicated if there's mural thrombus or calcium present at the intended site of deployment because it would prohibit penetration of the endo anchor into the aortic wall. So this is what it looks like here. Sorry, I don't have a. Here you have the endo anchor going into the proximal portion of the stent graft. So in the anchor registry, which was a prospective multi-center registry, in a subset of the study, there were 77 patients who had an existing endograft and were treated with endo anchors for late aortic neck complications. The majority of these patients had a type 1A endoleak. 65% of these patients had placement of an aortic extender cuff in addition to the endo anchors. They were able to achieve technical success in about 80% of these patients, and they defined technical success as no type 1A endoleak at completion angiography. There was a fairly high rate of aneurysm-related reinterventions. 9% needed secondary procedures for residual type 1 endoleak. And when they looked at the freedom from a subsequent type 1A endoleak at 1 year, it was about 77%. And no surprise, the highest rate of a recurrent type 1A endoleak on follow-up occurred in those subset of patients who were initially treated with a type 1A endoleak as their indication. What about a direct attack on the aortic neck for these late occurring complications? Well, the advantages are it's a percutaneous approach. There are lots of different treatment options. You can use coils, gel foam, thrombin, glue, onyx, or any combination of these. And it actually may be, in those subset of patients with a Nellix endograft who have a type 1A endoleak, this actually may be the first line of treatment. So here you see a CT scan demonstrating a proximal type 1A endoleak, this transcatheter angiogram confirming the proximal endoleak, and then the performance of an endoleakogram, usually using a reverse-shaped curved catheter to get into that endoleak cavity. Here, this patient was treated with embolization with coils to form a scaffold, followed by onyx injection. And here you see the completion angiogram where there's preserved patency of both the renal arteries and no residual endoleak. So in looking at the data available for a treatment of these type 1A endoleaks, there are multiple case reports, small numbers of patients, and all with very short follow-up. And nearly all of them demonstrate that you can technically treat these well at the time of presentation. In the largest series of patients to undergo embolization with On-X or On-X plus coils, this was just published in the JVS this year, this was 25 patients. They had 100% immediate technical success. They had three cases of non-target On-X embolization, but 28% of these patients had an endoleak recurrence, and four of these patients eventually died of sac rupture. What about raising the neck using chimneys, periscopes, or fenestrated or branched devices? Well, for chimney and periscope grafts, the advantages are that you're using standard off-the-shelf components, and they may be less technically challenging than using a fenestrated or a branched device in this setting. Here you see a CT scan where a patient's undergone endovascular repair, as well as a Palmas stent and has a persistent type 1A endoleak. There's resolution of the endoleak by raising the neck with an aortic extender cuff and two chimney grafts into the renal arteries. You can take this even further by using a four-vessel chimney combined with periscope grafts. Here there's a transfemoral periscopes for the renal arteries, transaxillary chimneys for the celiac trunk and SMA, and an aortic cuff, all to treat a type 1A endoleak. With regards to the available published data with regards to chimney and periscope grafts specifically for treating a type 1A endoleak, I was able to find three published series, again, with small numbers of patients. Again, similar to the studies looking at transcatheter embolization, pretty high technical success rate, an average of 1 to 2 chimneys per patient, but the subsequent type 1 endoleak rate is almost 20%. This study with shorter-term follow-up found no subsequent type 1 endoleaks. Dr. Quinones-Baldrich mentioned the Nelix endograft. I don't know if you have access to this, but it's a unique device where you have two balloon expandable covered stents Can you just go to the next slide? So the concept is that you have these endobags that fill the aneurysm sac, and if you're using it in conjunction with chimney grafts, you may be able to decrease the gutter leaks around the chimneys. So here's a situation where there's a CTA showing a type 1 endoleak proximally. Here, again, you see the angiogram confirming that. And this is a case where this is an aorto-uni-iliac graft, so that's why you only see one of the Nelix balloon expanded stents and bilateral renal chimney grafts to basically raise the neck, decrease the gutter formation, and maintaining patency of the renal grafts to treat this type 1A endoleak. So what are the data? Again, a very recently published series of 10 patients with chimney procedures in conjunction with Nelix to treat a type 1A endoleak after EVAR. Again, good technical success rate. There was one iatrogenic injury resulting in nephrectomy. There was one in-hospital death in a patient who actually presented with a ruptured aneurysm. That patient died of a ruptured aneurysm. And at a very short median follow-up, they had no evidence of subsequent type 1A endoleaks, and all the chimneys were patent. What about raising the neck using fenestrated or branch devices? The advantages are it's proven to be durable in primary repair, and it may be the best option if you really have no neck or a very short neck. The disadvantages are they can be technically challenging, especially when you're trying to salvage an endograft. There's inherent manufacturing delays, and they can be expensive. And they may not be feasible in those with a short primary body device. So I was able to find two series looking at using fenestrated and branch devices specifically in trying to salvage a failing endograft. one retrospective review of 26 patients treated either with a fenestrated proximal cuff or bifurcated fenestrated stent graft, technical success of 92%, 95% target vessel success with good target vessel patency up to 27 months. They had 5 reinterventions in follow-up, none for a subsequent type 1A endoleak. This is the published data from the Cleveland Clinic, where they reviewed 54 of those their patients with late failure after EVAR. The etiology of the failure was related to the proximal neck, and in 38 patients, it was specifically a type 1A endoleak. Their technical success rate was a little bit lower, 85%, 92% target vessel stenting. They had a fairly high secondary intervention rate at 37%. But if you look at this chart, which shows the indications for reintervention, there was only one reintervention for a type 1A endoleak. I'm just going to touch on hybrid repair. Obviously, you can always offer your patient a hybrid repair if you're bent on saving this endograft. Again, it significantly raises the proximal implantation site to an area of healthier aorta, and it still avoids the need for an aortic cross clamp. But as we know, these are not short operations, and these patients have a fairly high perioperative complications. And then finally, we can still salvage the failing endograft even with an open repair. I think earlier studies where the endografts were completely explanted reported high rates of morbidity and mortality in these patients. I think more often what we're doing when we do have to perform an open repair is that we don't explant all of the endograft. We perform this neo-neck procedure where we get the supraceliac aorta out for a cross clamp, but we preserve the proximal portion of the stent graft as long as the neck is not aneurysmal and or the first stent of the stent graft has not migrated into the aneurysm sac. And these are just some operative photos, not mine. But again, a supraceliac cross clamp, the aneurysm sac is opened. You preserve that bare stent and that proximal endograft and sew it with a woven graft with or without a Teflon ring. And you can also preserve the distal end of the stent graft as well. So I think late type 1A endoleaks are very challenging to treat. I think with endo anchors and coils and chimneys, you can successfully do them. But I think that the risk of a subsequent type 1A endoleak is still around 20 to 30% at 1 year. So probably even higher if we had longer follow-up. I think with fenestrated and branch devices, these have a decreased rate of subsequent type 1A endoleak, but they're more technically challenging. They obviously have manufacturing delays, and they're pretty costly. So perhaps we should, as Dr. Quinones-Baldrige mentioned, think about how to treat these patients up front a little more carefully. So, you know, I think that a lot of these endografts fail later because we're not really following the IFUs for the primary endograft. We should probably consider treating a short neck aneurysm with either a fenestrated device or an open repair instead of a standard EVAR. We know that branched and fenestrated repairs actually have a higher technical success rate when they're done primarily as opposed to for a salvage operation. And we may want to consider a more extensive primary repair in those patients who we think might have a tendency to fail, such as those with patients who are younger or those with a very strong family history of aneurysms. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jane. Any questions from the audience? Certainly there's got to be some controversy here, right?
There's no controversy. No controversy. Oh, Dr. Conti.
Uh-oh. Okay, Jane. No, that was great.
I tried to present some data. It was in all pictures.
And I think the whole session has been great. In terms of trying to get to an algorithm, though, because we see a lot of things being done, and I've had the privilege or opportunity to try to convert some of these patients, and the conversions are getting harder. Because the more things that are done, the more periaortic inflammation you end up with. So let's just take a couple of things. So first of all, glue and embolization, does it ever work or only if patients die of something else in 6 months?
Well, I mean, I think that the I the data are that are published would suggest that you can successfully treat these. Technical success. So no type 1 endoleak when you shoot your completion angiogram. I think that maybe your success would be better if you use a combination of, let's say, you know, creating a scaffold with coils and then filling it in with glue. I don't think that that's something that we go to. I think the unique situation, though, is if you if a patient with a Nellix endograft presents with a type 1A endoleak, because that's a very different way that the aneurysm has been treated, and you might have a higher technical success with that. But I don't think it's like a patch. I mean, you're trying to, you know, patch the neck, basically, and I'm not sure that that's a great
yeah, I'd
option,
like to, I mean, maybe the rest of the panel. I mean, it seems like that's a desperate situation for someone who
percutaneous, if you have a very sick patient who wouldn't tolerate any type of anesthetic agent.
You know, coils and glue.
I think that that's a really good, you know, question, and I agree with you. I think that those techniques with coil and glue really should be reserved for a patient with no other options who's not going to survive very long, because the reality is that's not a device failure. That's aortic failure at that level. And by just packing a bunch of Onyx or something in there, you're not addressing the key issue that you've landed the graft where the aorta has failed now. And so I think that the concept is you do have to go more proximal to healthy aorta to fix that problem.
Mike, I think your concerns are valid. I think my practice has evolved over time because I've tried. I get referred all the patients that have the type 1A endoleaks, and I've tried all the different techniques, and they all don't work until you go higher to the celiac and do a fenestrated repair, even in the elderly patients. And it's really a call to do the right procedure to begin with. If I have a patient now that comes in with a 15-millimeter neck, but it's a reverse cone diseased, thrombus-laden, calcified neck, but above their renal arteries they have a beautifully healthy aorta, I will do a fenestrated repair on that patient. It used to be that I would try and put an oversized endograft in there. The one interesting thing is I don't use 36-millimeter grafts anymore. Those were designed to treat aneurysmal necks, and I don't use them anymore. It's very rare that I see myself using those.
All right, I'll just add one final point to that discussion. I think there's only one absolute indication for conversion to open repair, and that's an infected stent graft. Everything else, you know, there's pluses and minuses of different approaches, but there are always endovascular options, especially if you're prepared to go upstream and especially if you're prepared to deal with branches by endovascular means. So I wouldn't necessarily say that an open conversion is going to result every time you have a failed endograft. And I certainly would say that if you have an infection, all the coils and all the glue in all the world are not going to help you.
I think I'd just like to add one more thing, and sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Bill, if you had something there.
I didn't start.
But, you know, I think, and I think Bill might have mentioned it with some things that Tara Mastracci has said before, but, you know, we always make these excuses that we're going to do something like coils or glue or something off-label, off-IFU, and that the patient's too sick for anything else. But the reality is we treat a lot of these patients, and if these patients live 4 or 5 years, that's going to fail. And so I think that we have to start thinking that a lot of these patients are going to live longer than we think they are. And so if we push the envelope and we're off IFU, we're going to encounter these problems. And if you're going to do something that is subject to failure in the future, you've got to fail forward. So whatever you do, you've got to have that ability to correct it with the next step that's not a crazy explant, you know, nightmare case. So if you put a bunch of chimneys or snorkels in and then that fails, then you have a very complex situation on your hands versus if you did stay in for renal and had the ability to come back later with a fenestrated or something approach. You know, there are different ways to look at that.
But can I also play the devil's advocate that everybody here has basically a IDE for a fenestrated or a branched device? I mean, so you know, there are people who, you know, don't have ready access to this device. A patient comes in symptomatic or ruptured, you can't modify your own device, you may not be able to raise the neck without the use of chimneys or, you know.
I totally agree. So, you know, I think there, you know, when we start talking about algorithms, you talked about patient's life expectancy. I think the other thing is, did you pick this up and is it symptomatic or not symptomatic? If it's somewhat elective that the patient is not ruptured, I think that that probably should be referred somewhere where it can be done right. But I do think that there is a role for these other sealing technologies and chimneys and snorkels to get a patient out of trouble who might otherwise die.
Jay, one more quick thing. So what's a reasonable situation to use anchors? I mean, is it for a small problem on one side? I think they're being used in a lot of different scenarios as a cure-all. And again, I'm trying to get to be algorithmic in what's really not a good idea. Can you comment on that a little bit?
I personally don't have any experience with the endo anchors. I think they were initially designed as a primary adjunct. I mean, as an adjunct to a primary stent graft. The data that I showed you was in the subset of patients in that registry who were treated specifically for late type 1 endoleak. I don't know if the panel wants to comment.
No, I I haven't used endo anchors. They were originally designed to prevent migration, and migration is really not an issue with most of these devices. I just wanted to make a comment and some food for thought. One, we have now done 52 perigraft arterial sac embolizations to induce thrombosis of the sac. In about 22 of these, they were done primary at the time of the implantation. And what's interesting is when you follow those patients, in most series, the shrinkage rate is about 50 to 60%. When you follow these patients, the shrinkage rate is about 80%. So there may be a role for inducing thrombosis of the surrounding blood around the graft at the time of implantation. It's something else to consider. And we have used actually that to treat type 2s and type 1 endoleaks with very, very good results. So one of the things that I would be against is the use of glue. Once you use glue, then you don't know if there's an endoleak or not. You do your CT scan and there's so much scatter, it's impossible unless the aneurysm is growing or stops growing. You really don't know. So inducing thrombosis of the sac is something else to consider.
One comment about endo anchors. I do have quite a bit of experience with endo anchors. Back in 2012, I started using them with fenestrated EVAR, and it does add a lot of cost to the procedure. I think that Medtronic is promoting using them up front as part of the index procedure. But I've found my use of endo anchors declining over time. The only thing I find them very useful for is grabbing endografts and repositioning them. So we call that endo anchor capture. If you have a limb that you need to grab and pull down or go up and actually manipulate the graft to twist it or move it, you can actually fire a screw into the graft, but not all the way, and you can actually torque the device and move it in situ and then withdraw the endo anchor. So that's a use for it.
And then treat the type 3 endoleak. Yeah, exactly.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.